Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to the luncheon of the Forum Club of Southwest Florida in what I hope will prove to be the most informative and inspiring 1.5 hours of your week. Let me state the obvious. I am not Beth Wessel, president. Beth turned a torn meniscus this morning into a detached meniscus. And it wasn't even something cool. She's just walking around. So give her her thoughts. I am not Francis Rooney, president-elect. He's out doing some important things around the world. I actually don't know how many calls Beth made and got no before I finally said yes. If we've not yet met, my name is John Smarge. I'm a 42-year resident of Naples. I am vice president of the Forum Club and your MC. Announcements, our next speaker will be Friday, January 12th, Chris Kimsinski, president and CEO of McDonald's Corporation, and it will be held at the Ritz-Carlton Beach Resort. So I'd ask you to please, for the courtesy of the members around you and our speaker, please silence your cell phones as we welcome to the lectern for today's invocation, Reverend Doug Learned.
The psalmist writes in times of trouble, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Let us pray. Living Lord, it seems we often come to you in times of trouble, sometimes only when we're in trouble. Thank you for being here for us, even and precisely when we are at times not there for you. Your gracious disposition toward us is what motivates us to pay it forward for those who struggle even more than we struggle ourselves. As we learn of so many very visible struggles in our world today, between peoples, nations, ethnicities, and religions, we confess that we have often confused having strong opinions about the plights of others while taking little action to relieve their suffering. We are in this room together to hear from a speaker who sought and still seeks to relieve the suffering of others through concrete actions and through testimony of her experience. Bless her in her speaking today, so that in hearing of her story, we might be better informed and motivated to serve. And we ask your blessing on our meal today, for those who prepared it and serve it, and the conversations we engage in around these tables, that we would be drawn together for the common good. In your name, amen.
Thank you, Reverend. If you look on our Forum Club website, we are branded as the premier speaking club in Southwest Florida. I would submit to you that there are two things that distinguish us even more, one of which is our membership. Around your table are some of the most interesting and amazing people you'll meet. I ask that you take the time during today's luncheon to talk to each other. The second thing that distinguishes us is our community outreach through our student programs. So if our speakers inform us, if our fellow members enrich us, certainly our student guests inspire us and provide optimism for our future. To introduce our students, I ask you to welcome student guest chair Jamie Anderson.
Thank you, and happy Hanukkah. I'm going to ask the students from Lorenzo Walker Technical High School to come up. We're going to start with Lorenzo Walker. The school opened its doors in 2006 and has grown from 150 students to 582 students today. Lorenzo Walker has programs tailored to students who want to attend a four-year university or who go straight into the workforce after graduation. The students are joined by their senior class advisor, Tara Barr. Tara? And even though he could not be here today, which is a little bit of the theme for today, we've got some pitch hitters here, they are generously sponsored by Sam McCullough. Please welcome the Lorenzo Walker Mustangs.
Good afternoon. My name is Daria Boatswain. I'm from Trinidad, and I'm a senior at Lorenzo Walker Technical High School. I currently am enrolled in the dental assistant program, but I plan to study nutrition and diuretics. It's nice to meet all of you.
Good afternoon. My name is Ariana Nostas. I am salutatorian of class of 2024 at Lorenzo Walker Technical High School. I am also in the dental assisting program. I volunteer at Meals of Hope, and I'm part of National Honor Society, and I hopefully will major in biology and continue my journey to dental school. It's a pleasure to see you all.
Good afternoon. My name is Violet Caswell. I'm a senior at Lorenzo Walker Technical High School. I'm involved in student council. I'm secretary. I'm involved in my church. I sing and every week. And I want to study the, I'm in the culinary program, and I'd like to study hospitality management, and I've already been accepted to 3 schools. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Sutton Crouch. I'm also a senior at Lorenzo Walker Technical High School, who is in the drafting and design program. However, if I would be lying if I told you that I was going into architecture, I actually plan on majoring in international relations. And currently at school, I am involved in student council as president and the co-president of Model UN, as well as the founder of our school newspaper. And I'm actually valedictorian. I've gotten into 7 schools so far, but I'm still looking forward to University of Florida. It's nice meeting all you all.
That's an impressive group. Thank you so much. Our second school is First Baptist Academy. The school combines academic excellence with a Christian education for students in preschool through 12th grade. Located off of Livingston Road, First Baptist Academy was established in 1996 and now has 878 students enrolled. The students are joined today by their teacher, Jennifer Hannon. Jennifer? And Forum Club member Jack Hall could not be present today, but as his grandson attends, he did not want to miss the opportunity to sponsor FBA, and we thank him in his absence for his generosity. Please welcome the First Baptist Academy Lions.
Hello, my name is Joey Adams. Thank you for having me back again this year. I'm now in my senior year of high school. As I look back on the past several years, I realize it has been an incredible and transformative time. I have enjoyed playing hockey, football, soccer, and running track. I have worked as a referee and volunteered coaching youth hockey and serving food at St. Matthew's House. I have also been the student council class president for the past 4 years. I have a passion for serving others and a strong desire to make an impact in this world. I have organized a fundraiser for the people suffering in and around Ukraine that raised over $21,000. After attending Form Club last year, I was inspired to help found a leadership club at my school to mentor students, teaching classes on leadership skills, personal branding, and engaging in community service. I am also currently involved in a research project studying how we can use pre-operative planning software to optimize results after reverse shoulder arthroplasty. After graduating from high school, I plan to attend college and eventually go into a medical science field where I feel I'd be able to apply my aptitude for helping others. It has been a real honor to share a little of my story with you today. I have a profound respect for the leaders in this room, and I appreciate and thank you for your time.
Hello, my name is Kennedy White, and it is my pleasure to be here. I'm a senior at First Baptist Academy, where I've attended school for the past 13 years. I participate in Collier County's Teen Court, which is a system at the local courthouse that allows teenage offenders to admit their crimes and rectify their actions. I have been a part of this program for approximately a year and a half, and I am pleased to say that I've seen so many lives changed by it. I also participate in tutoring other students, younger students, not only teaching them academic material to pass their classes, but also instilling a deep love of learning and motivation within these students. I also have had the wonderful opportunity of being a part of the Naples Council on World Affairs' scholarship opportunities for students to travel and learn different materials such as international relations this past summer. I plan on attending college next year. I have been accepted into 2 out of 3 of my colleges, but I'm still waiting to hear back from University of Florida. And I plan on, after graduating college, attending law school to pursue a career in intellectual property law. Thank you so much for your time.
Hello, my name is Ashton Taylor, and I am a senior attending FBA, First Baptist Academy. Thank you all for being so gracious by extending us this invitation to be here. I would like to share with you how a staple gun, some wood, and tarps changed the trajectory of my life. As a 10-year-old, I traveled with my family and church to Nicaragua. We had the opportunity to serve those in extreme poverty. Their houses had no permanent roofs or walls, and our team worked together to weatherproof their homes and build them beds to sleep on. But that was not their biggest need. Although their poverty was palpable, their greatest problem was lostness. We were able to share the hope that lasts forever, found in the love of God when he sent his son from heaven to earth to die on a cross for our sins and the sins of the world. But he did not just stay dead, he rose again victorious. He extends that hope to anyone and everyone who puts their trust in him alone, whether rich or poor. At that moment, I realized I wanted to spend the rest of my life helping people's needs, both physically and spiritually, by serving as a missionary in the name of Jesus. Thank you so much for your time.
Good afternoon, my name is Hannah Hansen, and I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to attend today. My hope for my future is to become a musical theater performer with a master's in fine arts. I'm preparing for that now as I attend First Baptist Academy and serve in lead roles in our theater department and as president of the drama club. I am also blessed to be able to serve in front of my church family weekly on the worship team, and I am participating in community theater in acting and student directing. I have also been blessed to graduate from the National League of Junior Cotillions and Student Leadership University. I hope to attend Liberty University in 2025. Thank you so much again, and I'm so grateful to be here today.
Who he will introduce. Please welcome Bill to the lectern.
John, thank you, and thanks for the pitch for the Navy SEAL Foundation. I appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have with us today a very special woman, Jessica Buchanan. Jessica is a highly sought-after speaker. She has written 2 books thus far, including a New York Times best-selling memoir. She has started her own book publishing company, Soul Speak Press. Its mission is to empower women to share their stories and make a difference in the world. She has been named one of the 150 women who will shake the world by Newsweek magazine. Her personal story has been one of the most highly viewed episodes in the history of the television program 60 Minutes. What has been Jessica's life's journey to this point? Has it been quiet and uneventful? No, not at all, as many of you probably know. While Jessica was growing up, she increasingly felt that she wanted to be a teacher and to volunteer to help those in need. This interest deepened while at college. During her college days, she used her summers to teach and volunteer in Honduras, South Sudan, and Rwanda. In 2006, a 27-year-old Jessica arrived in Nairobi, Kenya, with a teaching degree and long-held dreams to help educate African children. By 2009, she had met and married the man of her dreams, a native Swede named Eric Mandelbaum, who worked to coordinate humanitarian aid with local authorities in Africa. With dreams of starting a family, they moved from Nairobi to Somalia. Their future could not have been brighter. But then fate intervened. On October 25th, 2011, while on a routine mission in Somalia, Jessica and a male colleague were kidnapped at gunpoint by an organized gang of Somali land pirates and held for ransom of up to $45 million. Jessica and her colleague had been sold out by the very man responsible for protecting them. What came next was a story of grit, toughness, and courage, and a story that underscores the pride that each of us has in being an American. Please welcome Jessica Buchanan.
It's day 92 in the desert. I think the date is January 24th, but I just can't be sure anymore. I think it's around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I can tell because the sun is beginning to drop down to the right side of my mat, and I wonder how many more 3 o'clock suns am I going to stare at from out here. I'm still the only woman surrounded by dozens of Somali men. I'm in some of the most intense pain I think I've ever experienced in my life, and as I drag myself to a nearby bush to be sick, these men who've taken me away from everything I know mock me. They laugh at me. I'm a source of entertainment for them. The leader of the group, a man who calls himself Abdi, comes over to me and commands me to put on a hijab to cover up my blonde hair. He's tossing a brand new shiny AK-47 from one hand to the other. He's constantly in my face screaming, "Where is Big Money?" I try to explain to him for what feels like the millionth time. I am a teacher by profession. I am a humanitarian aid worker at heart. I am a woman of very little means. There is no big money. He forces me to follow him out into the desert. We walk for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. The sun is so hot. It's just beating down on my head. I can feel the soft fabric of my headscarf. I can smell his sweat. Finally, he stops abruptly and gets down onto the ground and picks up a stick. And he draws a number 7 in the sand. He looks at me and tells me my people have 7 days to come up with $18 million or... Tears begin streaming down my face as I comprehend the reality that I don't have any reason not to believe him. And then he cocks his head to one side and looks at me curiously and says, "Why are you crying?" And I say simply, "Because I'm not ready to die." 93 days earlier in October of 2011, I was happily working for a humanitarian aid organization. I was the education advisor for the Danish demining group. They were the mine action unit of the Danish Refugee Council. I essentially had the entire East Africa in my portfolio. I traveled to South Sudan, Northern Uganda, all over Somalia, Kenya, Rwanda. My job was to train our local staff who would go into villages and teach them about the safeties of firearm safety, mine risk education, and community safety and conflict management education. I loved my job. I'm a teacher by profession. I know it's not everybody's dream to go work in a place like Somalia, but it was mine. And I was, you know, living my best life, married to, as Bill said, the man of my dreams. He would love to hear that. And he was working for a separate organization doing a human rights law, essentially. And we were doing what we felt like was the right thing for us. We felt like we were making an impact, trying to make the world a better place. My organization had called upon me to go to the southern part. We were based in the northern part in Hargeisa, Somaliland, which is pretty safe, pretty peaceful area. Most NGOs were based there. We were being called upon to then go to the southern part and work in, do a training in our for our local staff in that part of the country. I didn't feel good about it. I had actually canceled the training two times before. Third time the scheduled training rolled around, I called my colleague, my counterpart, a Danish gentleman named Paul, and I explained I didn't feel safe, I didn't feel good about it. He essentially told me, if you don't get down here and do your job, we'll find somebody else who can. So, you know, again, it's hard to make people understand, but I really loved my job. I'd worked really hard to get there. I was a woman working in a predominantly male-based organization. I felt like I had to work really, really hard to produce as much as they did, and also, you know, be strong and brave, right? And so I thought, you know what, I'm a school teacher from Ohio. What's the worst that can happen? So I got on a UN plane, and I traveled down to Galkayo. The training was 3 days. The first 2 days were in the North office. I felt okay about that. Everything went well. What I was really concerned about was that third day, because I was going to have to be in transit, cross from the Northern office to the Southern office. We had to get across what they called the Green Line. There were two, the town was governed by two clans. They were opposing and they were often in conflict. We were never the targets, but you never knew if you were gonna get caught in something. So we get in our convoy of vehicles on October 25th, 2011. We drive to the Green Line, we get out, we cross the Green Line by foot. Then we are put in another convoy of vehicles and taken to the Southern office. I go do my training with the staff. Everything goes great. Around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we're waiting for our convoy of Land Cruisers to come pick us up. There are armed guards in the front, armed guards in the back, and then Paul and I with a driver and our security advisor, a local guy named Abdi Rizak, in the middle. I noticed that Abdi Rizak was acting a little odd. He kept picking up the phone, saying it was time to go, then saying, no, we're not ready. And there were lots of stops and starts. Finally, he said it was time. The vehicles come in. We climb into the middle vehicle, we take out through the gates, and we drive for about 10 minutes through the town of Galkayo, and I'm being generous when I say it's a town, it's like a little village, lots of people on foot, lots of goats running around. Suddenly, as we're driving, you know, I'm not paying attention, I'm looking down at my phone, sending an email, wondering what I'm gonna have for dinner that night, and if I have time to get my workout in. And another vehicle comes roaring up on the right side and stops and blocks us from continuing on and splashes mud up all over our windows and our windshield. I look up and I say out loud to the entire vehicle, what a jerk, who drives like that? Then I hear the crack of the butt of an AK-47 on the car hood. And it sounds like we're surrounded by very angry men. They're screaming in Somali. Abdi Rizak, who's sitting on my right, his door is pulled open, and there is a very angry man holding an AK dressed in a police uniform standing there. He pulls him out, slams him to the ground, hits him in the head with his gun, and then climbs in, puts the gun to my head, and starts screaming at the driver to drive. I don't know who he is. I don't know what he wants. I don't know where he's taking me. And as my head just bangs against the window and I'm tossed like a rag doll into the back seat of this vehicle, we're up on two wheels, we're down, we're up on two wheels, we're down. Paul's in the front seat, he's begging, please slow down to the driver because you're gonna kill us. I have two very basic and fundamental thoughts that are going through my head. The first one is, this is so bad. This is so bad. This is so bad. Whatever this is so bad that nothing in my life has prepared me for what is about to happen. I have no frame of reference to reach for to help me navigate this situation. And the second thing I keep thinking is that no matter how this thing turns out, even if they stopped right now and they kicked us out of the vehicle and just took our stuff and said we could walk back to town, I know that from this moment on, my life has changed forever because nothing's ever going to be the same again. We drive for hours, we stop, we change personnel, we drive some more, we stop, we change vehicles. We do this over and over and over again. At one point, there are a bunch of people in the back of the vehicle, and I can hear a high-pitched voice behind me speaking, and I think, my goodness, it's so very strange that a woman would be involved in this. Because, I mean, you know, whatever this is, it would be strange that there'd be a woman involved. And finally, my curiosity gets the best of me, and I turn around and see that it's a small child. He's wearing a belt of ammo, holding an AK-47 that's as big as he is. I would later come to learn that his name is Abdullahi. He is 11 years old at the time, and he'd already killed three people. He was there that night learning the family trade of kidnapping and ransom. Finally, after many, many hours of driving, we're out in the middle of just nowhere. It is so dark. There's no ambient light. There are no stars. Now the person sitting next to me has got a turban on his head, and he is got a machine gun that's so large it doesn't fit inside the Land Cruiser, so he's hanging out the window of the Land Cruiser with his firearm. We stop, and we're ordered out of the vehicle. I have myself pressed up against the Land Cruiser, just trying to disappear, and he comes over to me and he says, walk. And I think it's just this last will, this primal need to survive. I refuse, I say no. Walk, he says again. No. We go on like this for a few minutes, and then Paul comes over to me. He'd already come out the other side of the vehicle and comes over to me, and he takes my hand and he says, Jessica, you know we have to walk. So together, hand in hand, we start walking out into the desert. We fall, we're tripping, we're over thorn bushes and rocks. I'm just silently weeping. I am calling out to my mom, who I'd lost the year before, asking her to help me be strong, help me be bold, help me be dignified. I'm saying goodbye to my husband, Eric, and my father, my siblings. I can hear their chains of ammunition clinking together. It's a death march. More and more of them come out of the shadows until there are 20 and 30, and we're surrounded, and in my terror, it looks like they have bayonets attached to the ends of their guns, and all I can picture is my head leaving my body, and I don't know what I've done to deserve this. I'm only 32 years old, and I didn't even have the chance to become a mom. They order us to stop and get down on our knees, and this is the single most terrifying moment of my life thus far. And as I'm waiting for a bullet to pierce my brain, I hear the most beautiful word I think I've ever heard, and that is simply, sleep, one of them says. Shake my head a little bit. I don't think I heard that right. Sleep! Emotions on the ground. Lay down in the dirt and go to sleep. And that's exactly what we do. A few hours later, I wake up in what I can only describe as hell. because I'm a hostage now. I am no longer Jessica Buchanan. I am not a teacher. I'm not a humanitarian. I'm not a wife, a daughter, a sister. I'm not a human being anymore. I am simply a commodity. I am an American dollar sign that needs to be kept just alive enough so that I can be cashed in. And as my new reality unfolds before me, I see I have a very important job to do. And that is simply to just survive. Now, survival means different things to different people. I've come to understand that I think for most of us, it is a very human thing to want to survive. Now, because I'm a teacher, I'm going to share three lessons with you that I learned out there in the desert. And I'm looking for my younger folks here. I want you to hear me today, okay? All right, you're gonna remember this like lunatic lady teacher from Ohio, but I'm talking to you this morning because I want you to remember this as you go on through your lives, okay? The first thing I learned out there in the desert is that change is the author of our stories. Okay, if you think about your favorite movie or your favorite book, no great story ever comes about without some sort of significant change, right? Sometimes life is going to allow you to choose that change. And that is a great honor and opportunity. Oftentimes we make those changes through sheer will and determination. Maybe it's our lifestyle change or a move or a job or a relationship, but most of the time, change chooses you. And here's the deal, what it does is it does its thing and then it steps back and it waits to see how you're going to respond and what you're going to do with it. I can remember in some of the darkest moments of my captivity, I was sequestered to a mat about this size. And I would get up and pace it all day long. And the only time I was allowed to leave was when I needed to use the toilet. And I would say toilet. That was the only English word most of them knew. They would let me go to the nearest bush. I would do what I needed to do. But at some moments, the panic and the absolute stress of the situation would overtake me, and I would say, toilet, and I would go behind the bush, and I would scream silently into my headscarf, and I would just empty everything out. And I can remember just being doubled over, panting, saying, Jess, you're going to get through this thing, and you are going to move on. This is just a chapter in the story of your life. But here's the deal. Change doesn't want to just write a chapter. It wants to write the entire book. But how that story is told, how it's written, is entirely up to us. The second thing I've learned is that we have a difference. We have the choice to choose anything we want. Oftentimes, we can be in situations and we'll say, you know, I didn't have any other option. And I'm in a group here today with a lot of the folks who've got some really interesting life experiences, I'm sure. And if I had the opportunity to sit down with some of you and talk one-on-one, I would love to hear your stories of where you felt that your back was up against a wall and you felt like you didn't have an option. But what I know is that there are moments in our lives. This is the biggest lesson that I've ever learned, is that even within those moments where we feel like we don't have a choice, we always do. We are never without a choice. According to studies conducted by researchers for BetterUp, we are 6 times more likely to demonstrate strong resilience in the middle of a life-changing event if we can identify our own choice and autonomy in the middle of that change. So I had mentioned that I lost my mom prior to this. I'd lost her the year before the kidnapping happened and we lost her suddenly. She was young, she was 57. It was the biggest heartbreak of my life. And I was still very much in the throes of grieving when all of this took place. And I had been thinking about taking some time off from work after this particular trip. And I don't know, I was young and naive and I thought that I could like go sit in an ashram in India and grieve for 3 months and then I'd be done, because I thought that's the way things happen. I woke up one morning in the camp. I think it was probably around day 40. And I'm cold and I'm wet because I'm not in a shelter. We were never taken to a house. We were never taken to a shelter. We were never given a tent or a tarp. It was just open under trees all day and then out in open fields at night. And I'm like wringing my clothes out because they're wet. And I move my mat from the field to the tree that I'm going to spend the next 12 hours underneath. And I was really into yoga at the time. So when they would let me move around, I would do like my yoga stretches and work the kinks out. After sleeping on the ground all night, I was really sore. And I remember sitting at the base of a tree with my legs crisscrossed, and I had this like aha epiphany moment. I thought, you know, somewhere in my memory, I remember hearing that the Buddha reached enlightenment while he was sitting underneath a tree. And then I thought back to my religious, I grew up in the church, my Sunday school lessons all through growing up, thinking about the story about Jesus wandering through the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, wrestling with his own humanity, right? And the decisions that he had coming up. Temptation. And then I started thinking about like all of the iconic greats who I'd learned about in history or read about and watched movies, the people that we revere, and how every single one of them had a dark night of the soul. They had their own metaphorical desert. And here, I was in an actual one, so I didn't even have to get that artsy about thinking about it. I looked around and I thought, maybe this is my chance. Maybe I don't have to pay, you know, thousands of dollars to go sit in an ashram. I can just do it here for free. And so I decided to get really organized with my thoughts. And I decided that I was going to go back as far as I could remember to my very first memory from when I was 4 years old. And I was going to relive my entire life. So for example, when I was 4, my mom took me to the movie theater for the first time, and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs had just come out. And it was a hot July night in southern Indiana, and I remember she had this blue sundress on with little white flowers, and I can remember how suntanned and freckled her arms were. And I could, like, I got so into it that I could taste the saltiness of the popcorn, and I could taste the sweetness of the soda. And I remembered how I made her sit there until we were the very last ones in the theater, because I was 4 and I didn't know the difference between fantasy and reality, and I thought for sure Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs were gonna come out and greet me at the end. And I thought about the shape of her teeth when she laughed, and then one by one, the memories of just the most gorgeous life played out before me. And I knew that if I didn't get one more day, that I had been really lucky. Because I knew what it felt like to be loved. And I knew what it felt like to love. And when I couldn't remember anything else, I started making plans for the future. I didn't know if I was going to get them, if I was ever going to get out and make them happen and become a reality. But what it gave me was a place where I alone was in charge. No one could take that away from me. My body was being held hostage, but my mind had never been freer. Now the third thing, and this is my most constant and fundamental truth, is that change is our proof of life. Now normally I have a presentation and I like show you the proof of life video. If you're interested, you can Google me, proof of life video, if you want to see it. But for those of you who aren't aware, a proof of life call or proof of life video is when your kidnappers will prop you up in front of a video camera. They will coach you. That's a very nice term. They will demand that you message certain things, and they'll record it, and then they will distribute it to all of the major news and media outlets so the whole world can watch you begging for your life. It's a completely surreal experience, and I think we were probably 50 or so days in when we were forced to participate in this. And I remember coming back to the camp, and Paul and I, we weren't always together, but on this particular time, they were letting us talk and communicate, and we knew that we had, something had shifted after that. We were in it for the long haul after this. We had been holding on to hope that we were aid workers and that this thing was going to be taken care of quickly and remedied, and at that point, we knew it was just, it was going to be a long time before we got out of there. On the night that we were taken and we were being forced out into the desert to participate in this mock execution, essentially, I remember hitting my leg on a rock or something, and it cut me. And I can remember the blood dripping down my leg and pulling in between my toes, and it was sticky and warm, and I thought somehow I had the wherewithal to understand that this pain is actually a gift. It's actually good because it means that I'm still alive. I can still feel something. Because when things aren't changing, we're no longer living. We can look to history, we can look to nature, we can look to everything that we've just survived in the last several years and know that that's a fundamental truth. And then when things, we finally get used to how they are, inevitably something's gonna change again because that's just life. Remember that, that's just life, it's always gonna change. So it's January 24th, 2012. I have gotten really, really sick. I have a urinary tract infection that's gone untreated. They won't bring me a doctor. They won't bring me medicine. I need an IV. I need to be hospitalized. I am well on my way to a kidney infection, and I know I probably got 2 to 3 weeks left before I'm going to die. I pull my mat out from the tree and put it in the field where I'm going to sleep. We've been in this camp for about 6 days. It was very windy at this point. And every once in a while, the wind would die down, and we could hear something, like an engine, like a motor. And we were we knew we weren't close to a town, so we didn't think it was a generator. We thought maybe we were close to the sea. Maybe it was a boat. But we didn't know. We didn't know where we were. We moved about 50 to 60 times to different camps throughout the course of captivity. And there are two stars that come out at the same time every night. And I didn't know this until I'd spent all that time sleeping out under them. And I named one for my mom. And I would lay there every night when the sun would go down and these stars would come out, and they were big and bright and beautiful. And I would tell her about my day, which there wasn't really much to report most of the time. When you're not being terrorized, being a hostage is just horribly boring. But this night it was different, and I said to her, you know, I need you to go and tell God, you need to like work some connections here. You need to go and tell God that I need help, because if I don't get out of here soon, I don't think I'm gonna make it. So I go to sleep, and I wake up a couple hours later with this need to be sick. And I say the word toilet. There are 9 pirates on the ground that night. All of them are completely passed out, which was odd because there was at least one that was keeping watch throughout every single night that we were out there, but they were all passed out, stone cold, passed out. My need becomes urgent. Toilet, I say again, no one wakes up. So I have a small pen light that they had given me, so I start flashing it, and I get to the nearest bush, I do what I need to do, I come back to my mat, I wrap myself up in my blanket, and I can hear this, like, this sound like somebody is walking through grass and breaking it. And there are long desert grasses, and I'm thinking it's an animal, or maybe it's these beetles that would come out every night, and they would get in my hair and in my clothes, and I just really wasn't in the mood to deal with it. So I get up, I shake my blanket a couple of times, no bugs fall out of it. And then the pirate who's sleeping on my left next to me, the stars have been clouded up over and there's no moon and I really can't see much, but I can sense that he's standing on my left and that he is terrified. He's holding a firearm and he's whisper screaming at the other guys to wake up in Somali. There's a lot of moving around and mumbling and groaning and grappling for firearms, and then the night just erupts into automatic gunfire. He's hit, and he falls to the ground right next to me. They're all around at my feet. They're being hit by bullets. They're dropping to the ground, and all I can do is just, like, try to make myself as low and disappear under my blanket into the ground. And I'm just saying, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, just crying out. Because I can't imagine that there is a scenario where I'm going to survive this. And if I do, I'm pretty sure we're being kidnapped by another group, and I don't have the strength to survive that. I'm hearing some of the most horrific sounds all around me, and then somebody grabs my ankles and my shoulders. And I'm trying to fight back. I'm trying to keep the blanket around me. I'm trying to protect myself. And then I hear the sound of a young American man, his voice, and he knows my name. And he says, Jessica, we're the American military. You're safe. We're gonna take you home. You can stop hitting me now. And blanket's pulled away from my face. And I can't see anything. It's just so dark. I can make out all these dark figures around me. He's down at my eye level, and he helps me sit up. And all I can say is shock just overtakes me, and I start shaking. And I say over and over again, you're American? You're American? You're American. He says, we've been watching you for a very long time. We know how sick you've been. He has medicine and a bottle of clean water. One of them says to me, okay, do you know where your shoes are? Because we've got to get up, we've got to move. I don't know where my shoes are. He explains to me what's going to happen next. Okay, I'm going to stoop down, I'm going to pick you up, I'm going to throw you over my shoulder, I'm going to get us to the extraction point. And he does exactly that. And as he's like running through the desert, my head's bobbing up and down, I'm thinking, I am a school teacher from Ohio. How can this be my life? He puts me down at the edge of the camp, and I can start to see there's some light now. My first question is, where's Paul? Is he okay? Did he make it out alive? He's sitting there, he's on my left, and he leans over to me and he says, Jessica, do you know who these guys are? I'm kind of like, Paul, does it really matter? Like, I mean, we're getting out. He says, this is SEAL Team 6. These are the guys that got Osama bin Laden. Now, the guy that carries me out says, okay, Jessica, I'm going to go back and get your shoes. Like, my shoes were very important to him. And I say, okay, they're Birkenstocks. And while you're out there, there's this bag that I had on, could you bring it back for me? And he's like, okay, sure. So he goes out into God only knows what, gets my Birkenstocks, and he's bringing this roller bag, like this suitcase with him that the pirates had given me to like put my clothes in. I'm like, oh gosh, man, I hate to tell you, but that's not the right bag. And he like drops it to the ground and looks at me. I'm like, it's like this black powder bag. It has the blah, blah, blah. And he looks at me with so much familiarity because you know his wife has sent him in to go get something and he brought the wrong thing back. And he just drops it and goes back out, comes back with the right bag, sitting on my bookshelf in my office. I look at it a lot. They're not sure the premises are safe yet. So they have Paul and I lay down on the ground and about five of them lay down on top of us. And then the rest of them form a human shield around us to protect us until the helicopters come in. We get on a helicopter that then takes us to a landing strip in Galkayo. We're put on a plane and it's explained that we're going to be taken to a military base in Djibouti for medical care. While we're on the plane, the lights are up and I can finally kind of see what's going on. And I will never forget just sitting with my back against the wall of this plane, and they are celebrating, they are hooping, they are hollering. They want me to know that there's an NBA strike and who's playing in the Super Bowl. Someone has chips and salsa. Another one offers me a Snicker bar, and I can't make any words come out of my mouth. And I'm internally panicking because I'm thinking I've lost all of my social skills and I will never be able to have a conversation again. And then one of them comes over to me and he gets down on my level and he puts a bundle in my lap. And I look down and it's an American flag. And he says simply, "Welcome home, Jess." I don't know how many times I've told this story, but I still can't get through that part without crying. Because, you know, I'm at that point young and really stupid. I had no idea what it meant to belong to a country that knew where I was, that as soon as they found out that an American had been kidnapped, they started running exercises on the chance that they were going to be given the okay to go out and get me. And I know I'm running over on time. I'm just gonna end with this last story. We're taken to the military base in Djibouti and I'm put in the hospital and I just remember there is this Marine put in my room and for some reason there was no IV bag. He was just holding it. Like, that was his job, just to hold the IV bag. But he also was super funny guy, so I think they sent him in there because he had a great sense of humor. And he's telling me, "Oh, President Obama called your dad to tell him that you're coming home, that you're safe." And that's not right. It's true, he did. And he's telling me all this stuff, and I'm just like, I cannot fathom the vastness of the amount of people that had to be employed and included in an operation like this. And he had a tattoo on his forearm. It was the prisoner of war and the missing in action emblems. And he said, he pointed to it and he said, "This isn't just for military folks. This is for any American citizen. If we are able, we don't leave anyone behind." I will carry with me, I am fortunate. When I talk to people and I tell this story and they, you know, just look at me like their mouths hanging open. When I say I am one lucky girl, boy, do I mean it. I think we all know how privileged we are. But it's in those moments where all hope is gone, seemingly, and everything feels absolutely impossible. Hope always. You may not need 26 Navy SEALs to come in. Hopefully you don't. But I just want to serve as a reminder today of what it means to be human, what it means to be grateful, and what it means to be an American. Thank you. God bless you. God bless America.
People have never seen that before. Never. Can I tell a secret? I've got tears in my eyes, too. Wow. We've only got time for a couple of questions, so just real quick. Thank you. As you went through this ordeal, did your relationship with your captors change, or did you try to change it along the way?
I would say that I learned a lot about connection. I think that, yes, it changed. It went from being completely terrified to some sort of strange, comfortable existence to then being terrified. The timing was impeccable. I would not... 93 days is a long time, and I wouldn't want to do it again. But I think the treatment was going to start getting worse as time went on, because kidnapping people is an expensive operation.
Thank you. How did you go about rebuilding your life after being rescued? It must have taken time to sort of get back to break even.
Yeah. How much time do you all have? I would say my short answer to that is that I found that things happen, full stop, and it's up to us to make meaning out of them. And so once I decided that I wanted it to mean something and I wanted to try to figure out a way to pay it forward and make it meaningful in my life, that helped me rebuild.
One question was, how did the U.S. government know where you were?
I do
not know.
Maybe
the Lieutenant Commander knows.
I'll let you answer.
I can't speak to that one. Excellent answer. So not sure.
I don't know.
Got to be satellites. Got to be a lot of different things. You talked about getting sick, and you got the urinary tract infection. Did you alter your approach to your captors at all? Did it change anything, or did it just become more desperate?
I think that it altered. I think there's like an attitude of feigned respect that you have to take on. I think I received better treatment than Paul did because I didn't really stand up to them. I just looked at the ground a lot and said thank you and please and tried to be as respectful as possible because they've always got the upper hand. And I think the sicker I got, the more they knew they had the upper hand. And so I wasn't to the point where I didn't care. I think I just continued carrying on the way I had. Does that answer it? Yeah.
We have a final question. Were you a born-again Christian, or did you have your faith throughout your life? And how did this event affect your faith in God?
Oh, I've definitely been a person of faith all my life. Grew up in the church, and that was a large motivator, I think, for why I went to Africa to work in the first place. I was going through, God and I were... We were having some words when all of this happened because I was grieving my mom and really questioning some things. But I like to say that God took me out to the desert to shake me up a little bit.
Let's thank Jesse Buchanan. Let's also thank the United States Navy SEALs.
If Sam Seaman is in the audience, Sam,